Hello and welcome to Doc Talks, Doctors of BC production, a first-time vodcast. I would like to begin by acknowledging the land that which I am on. I am on the unceded territory of the Coast Salish people, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh. I am honored to be here as a settler and coming to all of you today as in my role as the president of Doctors of BC. I am thrilled to introduce a panel of near and dear friends, Jane Morley, Lisa Hamilton, and Dr. Linda Ueda. We are here gathered to talk about ACEs and their effect on health and well-being, and what the health and justice system can do in order to change the way that we currently do things and move in a direction that is helpful for our families, our communities, and ourselves. So thank you for joining me. Do you want to start off, Dr. Ueda?
Hi, thanks, Rami. I'm Dr. Linda Ueda. I'm a family physician. I work at several settings. I work at the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital, and I also work for Fraser Health Youth Clinics. And so I'm joining you today to share a little bit about my knowledge and background about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and trauma and attachment. So that's me. Thank you for having me. And I am joining you today from the unceded territory of the Kwantlen, Coetzee, and Semiahmoo First Nation.
Thanks so much, Linda. And Lisa.
Thank you, Dr. Dosage. I'm Lisa Hamilton. I am currently the president of the Law Society of BC. Very happy to be here. I'm also a family law lawyer and mediator and arbitrator, also a parenting coordinator. I've practiced family law for a very long time. And I am appearing here very gratefully from the unceded territory of the Coast Salish people. And that includes the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh people. Thanks for having me.
And Jane.
Hi, I'm Jane Morley. I'm living on the island of Sedais. It's also known as Pender Island, one of the Gulf Islands, and I'm very grateful to work and live my life there. I'm a lawyer by profession, practiced law for many years in Victoria, partly family, mostly family, but not entirely family, and then became a mediator. And did that, and I've done various other things along the way. But right now, what I'm involved in is I'm a part of Access to Justice BC, which is a network of various leaders from different organizations within the justice sector that have come together to try to do something about justice. And specifically, I'm working on a project that is about to launch called the Transform the Family Justice System Collaborative. And I'm just delighted at this development of the doctors and the lawyers working together, because that's exactly what we hope happens. So thank you for inviting me on the panel.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you from all our panelists for the warm introduction. We're going to get right into it, and I'm going to start with Dr. Ueda and your take on ACEs. What are ACEs, and why do ACEs matter?
I learned about the ACEs study after I had joined the collaborative, the Child and Youth Mental Health and Substance Use Collaborative, that was supported by the Doctors of BC and the BC government. Essentially, it's a study that was published in 1998 by Drs. Felitti and Anda, and they studied over 17,000 middle-class, largely college-educated people. And what they found was that there's a dose-response relationship between the amount of adversity that a child experiences before the age of 18 and all sorts of mental and physical outcomes, anything from COPD, cancer, liver disease, things like addictions, so you know how much you smoke, sexually transmitted infections, the rate of pregnancy. And so it was a real eye-opener that what happens to us actually shapes the way our body's physiology works and the way we end up developing disease. And so I think this really hit home to us that what happens to us as a society, as well as at an individual level, is really, really important. And, you know, coming together as physicians and lawyers, we can start to affect change at a higher level. that's why this work is really important to me.
Thank you, Linda. What, in your opinion, does divorce and separation have to do with ACEs?
Losing a parent through a divorce or separation is, in fact, one of the ACEs. So what they studied initially was they took a look at all sorts of things that could happen in childhood, and then they narrowed it down to the top 10 events that would happen. So the first five are individual, and the second five are family systems. So the first five include abuse and neglect. So did you experience emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse? Or did you experience physical or emotional neglect? The second five include the family system. So did you experience somebody in the home with mental illness? Did you experience somebody in the home with substance abuse? Did you witness violence in the home? Did you lose a parent through separation or divorce? Or did you have a family member incarcerated? And so it is in fact one of the 10 ACEs that are included in that study. So not only is it one of the ACEs, but and we're talking about the adverse childhood experiences, but in my opinion, we need to zoom out a little bit and talk also about the quality of the relationships that happen. And those are the day-to-day things. So when we're talking about ACEs, we're talking about big, you know, bigger traumatic issues. But what also impacts a child when they're, you know, kind of caught in this tug of war is they're experiencing the emotional milieu of the family. And so if the parents are stressed because they're going through this conflict, they're going through the separation, the child has no choice but to download these emotional effects. And that affects us, like I said before, at a cellular level, not only at a behavioral level. It literally can turn off and turn on the expression of our genes.
Thank you so much for that informative outlook and perspective. I'm going to ask Lisa Hamilton now. Can you please tell me on the perspective of from a legal and a justice approach to what you're hearing about ACEs, and why is this important now? How is this relevant within the COVID-19 pandemic context? And what have you learned from a justice perspective?
Well, what Dr. Yuida was just saying really, really rings true. I see this day to day in my practice, some of the effects on children and on families of toxic stress in terms of separation and what they're going through. And COVID, I would say, anecdotally, the pandemic's really, in some ways, made it worse. There's a lot of anxiety out there. There's also an increase, as statistics tell us, that there's about a 30% increase in separations and divorces. So you've got that going on as well. Combined with some court backlog that happened during the pandemic. So you've got people really desperate to try and find solutions and find resolution to their ongoing conflict and sort of desperate to get it done as soon as possible and not really knowing where to turn. So a heck of a lot of anxiety out there, I would say.
Now I'm going to ask Jane, in your perspective, you did this for a long time and you've been involved with family law and justice system as a whole, and you've alluded to transforming the family justice system. Can I ask why now?
Well, because it's so compelling. I really think that this the adverse childhood experiences must be described as a major public health issue. It's so impactful, and it impacts not just children immediately in the immediate situation, but as they get to be adults, but also their children. And it's intergenerational. And I understand that's true at a cellular level, as well as all the behavioral reasons why it might be intergenerational. So it's a major public health issue. And now is always the time to deal with major issues. In terms of the justice system, like, why are we talking about transforming the family justice system now? Partly because we got educated before the pandemic, a couple of years back, about ACEs, and recognized that the justice system, the family justice system, has a role to play in all this. Partly because it is very stressful for people to be going to court, for example. We have a model which is adversarial, and there's good reasons for that model. And sometimes that's exactly what we need to use. But it is that adversarial model is actually doing harm in the sense that it's escalating the conflict and making things worse and making it more difficult for parents to be the parents they need to be as they're going through these difficult life issues. So we got educated and we said, we've got to do something. But not only is it that we may be doing harm within the family justice system, but we also have a lot of opportunity to do some good. Because of those 10 ACEs that Linda went through, virtually all of them play out in the family justice system. So there's the abuse ones that in the child protection part of the family justice system, there's separation and divorce, there's family violence, which plays out in the separation and divorce cases, but also in the criminal courts. And then the ones that are most problematic, there's often elements of mental health issues and substance abuse issues. And of course, the incarceration of a parent or a family member involves the justice system. So we've got opportunities to do something about it here. And I think a strong sense of obligation, because that's what justice is about. Justice is about people being able to live a good life. So we should be involved.
Thank you for that. I am going to delve a little further into this conversation, and I will offer that I do feel that this is highly personal for me as well, having to have used access to family law and family justice system during the pandemic myself. So I speak from a lens of a personal experience, but what I've also experienced on the lens of treating and taking care of patients, which are my youth, but also families that have had these adversarial consequences and being placed in situations of toxic stress. What do you think that doctors and lawyers, I mean, we're coming together for the first time in the history of our organization, really, we are profoundly going to change our landscape in this embarking on this intersectoral allyship and partnership. What are some of your hopes? What do you feel like we would be great at just looking at achieving? I mean, I know getting us together in one room when we know that doctors and lawyers are often pitted against one another is that we don't have this great relationship, but I am hopeful. And when I hear you and the zest for our opportunities of bridging conversations and dialogue, what does that mean to each of you?
I've been working in this area of justice reform, but not just justice reform, also policy related to the welfare and of children and families for many years. And I haven't read a report about reform that hasn't said it. We need to break down the silos. We need to collaborate. And I believe that firmly. For me, the big challenge is how do we actually do it? Because it's not enough to have it in reports telling us that we should do it. There's reasons we don't do it. And we don't do it because partly because we're more comfortable in our silos, because, you know, lawyers don't really understand what doctors do and doctors don't understand what lawyers do. And we, you know, I've got educated in the law. I don't want to be mucking around in other areas. But the truth is we have to find ways of working together for the benefit of children and youth. And we have to start somewhere. And just getting to know each other and talking about what we might do together and then proceeding to do some things together is a start. It's what we have to do.
So I would totally agree with Jane. You know, I've been doing education in the community around mental health issues and relationships. And what I really think we need to tap into is changing our culture as a whole. And we're only going to do that by breaking down silos. That culture change is going to involve education. I think we're lucky now because we have the evidence behind us. There's proof now that shows that healthy relationships really do buffer children, even if they're in situations which are not ideal. If they have supportive relationships around them, that's where they will gain the resilience to overcome these situations. And all of that, my hope is that helps build empathy in our society, because I think that we are really losing that ability. And, you know, we had that talk last night about racism, and there's all of these things that if we had more empathy for one another and understanding, then that would grow. the science is pointing us towards the fact that if we grow that, we will naturally make the good choices, the good decisions that support healthy outcomes.
You raised some really good points there. I want to hear from Lisa as well, from your perspective, Lisa.
I love that point about empathy. And isn't that cool? Because that was the theme for Mental Health Week. And I've been really reflecting on empathy and in thinking about this topic as well. And Jane's point about silos. There's in practicing in family law for so many years, you come to realize relatively quickly, and in some cases not so quickly, that only a small portion of your clients' issues are legal. And we're all busy. We're busy professionals. And yeah, it's a lot easier to just focus on the law and what's the next case and do your best in court. But really, if we're truly doing a good service for our client, we really owe it to them to put them in the center of that and to consider the welfare of their children, especially with all the science, the brain science on ACEs and the effects on children and the families going through it. We've got to pay attention to the non-legal issues, the medical issues, the psychological issues. And I think to myself, some of the most rewarding work that I've done are in groups where it has been, where broken down silos and actually collaborating together, and collaborative divorce work comes to mind when you've got parenting coaches working side by side with lawyers on the same team to help the family. And you've got child experts working together, and you actually pick up the phone and you talk to somebody who's outside of your profession. And every time you do that, you learn something for the benefit of the client and for yourself as a professional.
I think that's very helpful. Great insights again. Jane, I'm going to ask you a pointed question about what do you think needs to change immediately? What is something that is so unsettling that you have witnessed or that you see that we need to change immediately if we can put some pressure on a place or a pain point in the system?
Well, that is putting me on the spot because I spend a lot of my time thinking about the longer term change that we need. And to specifically say there is one thing is difficult, but I do believe that one place where it will be very helpful to work, and already a lot of good work is done, is to try to create more opportunities for non-adversarial approaches. And I recognize that they aren't always the answer, but we do know that this is about toxic stress. Like that's what the brain science says. And so if we can, in the justice system, reduce that toxic stress and really make an analysis of where are the biggest points of the toxic stress. And even when we have to go to court, there are ways of decreasing the toxic stress, having one judge who looks after everything, for example. There are solutions out there and they have been discussed. But I think that what we need to do now is do a real concerted effort. And if you don't mind, I want to just come back to something that Linda said about cultural change. I think we have a real asset and a reason to do this now, and that is in our Indigenous population and the Indigenous peoples in BC and the whole move to reconciliation. Because a lot of the discussions that we've had, and we've already started these discussions about taking an intersectoral approach, they're about being holistic. They're about looking at everything from the perspective of the child, nestled in the family, nestled in the community. That's what that, and that is exactly as my understanding of what Indigenous laws, and there's not just one, but Indigenous approaches and laws are all about. So we have the opportunity here to both move on the road to reconciliation and learn a whole lot and transform our way of thinking and doing things. To me, that's kind of central.
That was a beautiful response. Jane, you touched on some really great points there. I think bringing it back to a holistic perspective and with the guidance of our Indigenous peoples and their lived experience and their learning it throughout their journey, and for us to have even a two-way of seeing, you know, I think moving forward in a way that what we are creating, and sometimes I mean, the healthcare system I can speak to as well, is that we are causing more problems because of the way that we operate. And our current operating systems are just not okay, because we're not necessarily promoting health and well-being. We are being in a reactive way in responding to our immediate action that's required. And so you also bring up the points of that the way that we're moving, there are many things, and there's just not one thing, but you did speak on toxic stress, and that's very personal. Again, I think toxic stress and mitigating the response within, obviously, our children, as Linda has so eloquently described, is that downloading all the way to our gene expression and understanding that risk of toxic stress. I'm going to push it back to Linda again to ask about this toxic stress. And we do know that different ways of practice, such as trauma-informed practice, and if we take that lens and that approach, how does that affect our toxic stress, Linda, either as individuals or in our families and communities?
Maybe I'll back up a little bit just to help our audience understand that toxic stress is different from your everyday moderate, you know, to low levels of stress. We're talking about levels of stress that are beyond most people's capacity to sustain, you know, their resilience. So we know actually that low levels and moderate levels of stress actually help people do better. When they can overcome those little things, people actually gain a sense of, wow, I did that. I can push forward. I can do this. But when we go into this, the area of toxic stress, now we're starting to change our stress hormones. We're having more elevated cortisol levels. And that actually increases things like blood pressure and heart rate. It increases the sugar, which leads to diabetes. Muscle tension, you know, people get aches and pains all over their bodies. They get backache, they get headaches. And so we know that if we push people too far, their ability to bounce back from adversity really drops. And so if we know that, then we can shift our systems. You know, we can reach them at a macro level. This is a fix that has to be approached from all sides. It's not just an individual fix. It's also, we have to take a look at what we're doing at very high levels across our societies to support people. It's the wonderful thing about it is that when I step back and I think about my level of resilience as I'm parenting, I know that if I allow myself to put too much on my plate, I can no longer be effective for my kids, for my husband, for my friends. And so that's how I dial it back at an individual level. But then doing things like this and working with all of you at a systems level also contributes to changing this issue.
Lisa, I'm going to ask you, how do you see toxic stress, both as a lawyer, but someone that's had to experience this firsthand as well?
Good question, Remy. So in terms of being a lawyer, I see pretty much every week, as I mediate on Zoom these days, I see effects of toxic stress and toxic stress on clients and on children. And I've interviewed children as parenting coordinator from time to time. And the effects on children, I would say, goes back to the ACEs. You see these kids engaging in high-risk behavior. You see them self-harming. You see them being defiant, not going to school. You see them taking sides with a parent because it's far easier than being in the middle of conflict, and engaging in substance use. And you know that the outcomes, if they survive that, are not good. And in terms of personally, as you know, Remy, I've had two experiences where I've been through the justice system in a way. One very very amicable way with my ex, and we had amicably separated and probably did it about record speed in 3 months, had everything resolved. And we certainly weren't perfect, but we had supports and we had enough trust to sort of have a respectful co-parenting relationship. And our three boys are healthy, happy adults. My oldest are 30 and my little guy's 25. And I tell clients that look long-term. Unfortunately, I also experienced the opposite end of the spectrum when I repartnered. My partner went through a very, very high conflict divorce. There's gaps in terms of support when you go through a high conflict divorce, and the adversarial process, I would say, is does not add to it. Certainly, it's tragic because I've experienced when my stepdaughters were alienated. And I've experienced when they moved away the youngest actually took her life right after she had moved away from all of her supports of her father and her grandparents and her soccer and her schoolmates. And that resilience that she hung on to was gone. And so it really informs my work as a lawyer and my passion for us looking at this as more than a legal issue. This is a medical and a health crisis, really. And I always encourage clients that have children to look long-term and to think, instead of fussing about a particular legal schedule or a case law, to think, what do you want your children to be like when they're, do you want them to live into their 20s and 30s? And do you want them to be productive adults who are actually happy? And do you want them, no matter what the schedule looks like, to actually experience their childhood? And if you ask parents, they would invariably, almost always say yes. And so with the work in terms of knowing about ACEs and trauma informed and some encouragement for early resolution, as Jane has mentioned, can sure go a long way to help.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa, and for you to be so vulnerable and open in sharing such a devastating consequence. And hearing you say that is, it's truly disheartening when, you know, kids are pushed, unfortunately, and we see this often, and I know Linda sees this often as well in her practice, is that we get to that point of no return. That's someone's life, that's someone's child, that was your child. And how do we come back from that? Because when we lead with the intention, and I think about my own practice or my own experience, I think about, we're all well-intentioned. We go to medical school and law school beaming to make a difference. And as we're advocating and impassioned by our reason for being and for trying to make a difference in the lives of our clients and our patients, we are beholden to the systems that sometimes disable us from doing the work that we really meant to. I was really touched by what you said, that, you know, what guides you and your moral compass and your vision is for other people, and it's bigger than the actual present moment. And I do like the fact that you touched on high conflict divorce, which also is a different way to do things and needs a different way of operating, as well as this adversarial system that currently exists. But you also raise a point of, if we knew how to care better, and if we knew how to show up better, maybe something such as a trauma-informed practice or a strategy in order to wrap ourselves around our community and our clients and patients a little bit better, then maybe we would have different outcomes. Jane, I'm going to ask you a little bit about what trauma-informed practice means to you, and whether it's using the wisdom and the learnings of the Indigenous people and all of the work that you've done in your career. Please let me know what that means to you.
Well, you know, I think that trauma-informed is a terminology that's been used before, at least in the justice sector, we really started talking about adverse childhood experiences. And to me, the brain science behind, and I feel like I just know a little tiny bit of that, but it's helped me understand what is going on and given me hope, actually, because of the part of it that Linda was talking about, the resilience aspects of it. There actually are things we can do. And there's things that lawyers can do in their practice. There's things that physicians can do in their practice. But there's also, even more importantly, things we can do together. And, you know, I think there's probably a commonality in between doctors and lawyers that we have a strong sense of service, a strong sense of wanting to do the best for our patients or our clients. And maybe even a bit of an overdeveloped sense of that the responsibility is all on our shoulders to do it. The truth of the matter is we can't. We cannot do it ourselves. And part of what I understand from the brain science of resilience is that it's a lot about building up the capacity of our clients and patients to be able to manage the stress themselves and in circumstances that are very difficult. So, you know, we then, our role changes. We become more like coaches almost and helpers along the way, as opposed to the knights on the horse that are going to go and, you know, vanquish the foe. And I mean, that may be a metaphor that's more relevant to lawyers than to doctors. I'm sure it probably is. But that sense that it's us that has to do it in an individual case, when in fact we're doctors and lawyers are in systems that themselves are creating issues. And while no one lawyer or doctor can make that difference for the system, if we get together and we talk about it and we think about how it could be, we can be very powerful together.
And that's why we're here today. Thank you so much, Jane. We are better together. And I think we have this unique opportunity to really reframe the way we participate and get back to the reason that we do this and get back to our roots of empathy and to understand and use our compassion to actually show up in a different way and collaborate and create a new tomorrow, especially for our children. Lisa, I will always think of that in the forefront of my mind. And, you know, part of our advocacy, as I know Linda's as well, is guided by our own lived experience and what we see with our patients and our communities. And with that, Linda, I want to ask your opinion on trauma-informed care. What does trauma-informed practice mean to you? And what does it look like, both in your practice and potentially in the justice system?
My understanding of trauma-informed practice really came about through my own experience in parenting. And so as I was raising my children, I had questions about what I should do, what approach I should take. And so I turned to the evidence and started learning about how all of these things come together. And so when I'm with my patients, it's almost always, it comes back to the things that I learned about parenting. It comes back to relationships and the quality of what's going on in the interaction between myself and my patient. So much of that communication is nonverbal. And so when people ask me, well, what is trauma-informed practice? It's hard to explain, but it's a way of being. It's a way of showing up, and it's a way of seeing and feeling the person that's in front of me. So first of all, understanding the science, understanding that if somebody has experienced a whole lot of trauma, their nervous system is going to be built very differently from mine. And so if I can get curious, if I can ask them questions about what happened to them, I can start to understand what might trigger them. And in that way, I can tailor my approach to what they need in certain situations. And so, you know, we haven't really brought up attachment theory, but I almost think that's more important than the ACEs study, because attachment theory starts to teach us about what it is about a certain type of relationship that actually transmits resilience to somebody. So I talked about the fact that we can tap out our resilience, but Jane was also speaking about the fact that we can also build people's resilience. We also know that good, healthy relationships actually decrease that physiologic stress response. So when we're with safe people that make us feel seen and heard and valued, our blood pressure drops, our heart rate drops, our stress hormones drop. And so that in itself, just being with somebody who makes you feel that way, literally can shut off that toxic stress that you're experiencing. So what can doctors and lawyers do? We can actually buffer not only the children, but also the parents. So we can be that, if we're centered enough in our own well-being, we can help our clients, our patients, feel that reduced amount of stress just simply by being with us. And I've seen it and I felt it. And I can tell you that it reduces my risk of burnout, because just in the way that I'm being with my patient, I can feel like I've made a difference. It has nothing to do with tests, has nothing to do with medications. It's just the way I am with my patient.
Thank you, Linda, for sharing that. Again, wonderful insights. And I love the way that you said that it's a way of being and a way of showing up. And I feel similarly. I feel that we've learned about trauma-informed practice, but it is the ability to show up for someone and creating a safe space and allowing them to feel safe enough to be able to even open up and share a part of themselves and their, maybe sometimes their most vulnerable self. And I feel that traditionally some of our systems haven't allowed for that. Either we don't have enough time with our patients, and the healthcare system doesn't necessarily honor that time and space with our patients and allow for that connection. But I do think that when we are rooted in that with a good family doctor or an opportunity to meet the children where they're at, whether in the youth clinic or whatever setting it is, the people that get to connect with these children or families at this level have an opportunity to really influence, you're right, their resilience and their ability to be supported. And sometimes that is a caring individual, and that could be your doctor. As well as I feel that if you have a great team of lawyers or people supporting you that see you in that way, which I've been lucky to have some great representation, because there has been opportunity to create a safe space within such a context of a very difficult system to navigate. I'm going to ask Lisa, and what ways in your practice do you feel, or the lawyers that surround you that have taken some pieces that might be helpful to use a trauma-informed lens?
I think listening, like being a really, really good listener, and Linda's right, taking the time to actually be there and be present and actually listen, because everybody's different and everyone's had a different lived experience. Really listening and helping them craft informed goals, and actually paying attention to their goals, not your goals or anybody else's goals. What do they want? And empowering them in any way you can, whether that's design of a mediation process or a support person there, or anything that's going to make them feel comfortable and empowered to be able to do good things, make good decisions for themselves and their family.
Thank you. And Jane, same question to you. How do you think this lens of being trauma-informed will just impact the way we operate in our system?
I think it's going to impact on various levels. And I do think that if we're going to make change, we have to make change on different levels. It's going to impact the way people analyze what the issues are, because if we understand the impacts of trauma and we understand that the importance of resilience in dealing with trauma and how resilience can be strengthened rather than undermined, then we can practice differently our various professions, but we can also design our systems differently. And coming back to this wonderful alliance that seems to be blossoming between doctors and lawyers and hopefully other professions over time, I think that we can problem solve around these issues. We can bring our own expertise to the table, but understand that it's not the only expertise. It's not the only way to deal with trauma. But if we're really informed about trauma, then we also have the will to do something about it.
Well said. Awareness leads to action, which leads to allyship, and change is inevitable. So I do feel that we are embarking on something truly special and remarkable for the sake of one another, our own respective career and organizations, but also more importantly for our patients, our clients, our families, and for the sake of children's mental health and well-being, and to protect them and to mitigate the risks of ACEs. What if people are feeling anxious? What if we've got doctors and lawyers and they just don't know where to start, or what does this mean for them? What would you say to them? What would the advice be? And any one of you can respond that feels comfortable.
I'd say to them, I'd talk to them about what they care about. And I'd say to them, you can contribute. You know, I've done a lot of thinking about how do you actually bring about change, especially in systems which are set up to really maintain themselves the status quo. You know, that's the nature of a system, is it wants to keep itself as it is. So how do you do that? I think one thing you don't do is you just don't tell them all how bad it is and all of that. They may feel very badly about that, but then that just puts them back into themselves and a feeling of powerlessness. And I think we need to empower. And how do we empower? We say and we mean, if you get started, if you start doing some things with others, you will find heading towards goals that you care about, that are about your patients, that are about your clients, then you can make a difference. It may be only just one little small thing, but that small thing will have an impact on individuals, and also could be picked up, especially if we work together and have some structures of working together. It could be picked up and handed on to somebody else and learned about and applied in other places. So my advice would be, become a participant in this. Become a participant in change.
Perfectly articulated, Jane. And Lisa, do you want to share something?
Sure. I was going to say, I don't think doctors or lawyers should be anxious at all. I think they should embrace the learning opportunity. And we're all human. We're not perfect. And I always think of I remember my mentor telling me when I was a junior lawyer, I looked up to her so much and I said, well, what is it like to actually know everything? And she said, are you kidding me? I learned something every week. And she's a family law lawyer. So I always remember that and think there's a reason why we have continuing legal education. And I think you have the equivalent. Embrace the learning, learn about ACEs, learn about being trauma-informed, learn from your clients, learn from what they say, learn from your personal experiences going through life. Everything helps us as lawyers. And I imagine as doctors as well, as professionals, all that experience. So embrace it.
And I'm going to completely agree with both of you. So the reason why I've been educating is because I'm so hopeful. You know, now that we know better, we can do better. And I've seen families shift this dynamic. I have a good friend who does a lot of speaking with me, and she's taught me about the trauma and attachment problems in her own family. But she's a grandmother now, and she sees her children, along with her help, breaking that cycle. And, you know, she's just so excited and so happy about the evidence. And it really is just about changing and learning new tools, new behaviors, new ways to respond to our children. So that's what gives me hope, is that we can do this. It's going to take a long time to change, but there are things that we can do on a daily basis to get there.
Well, that is a great way to put it, because I think if we look at the status quo, what's the worst that could happen? We could go up from here. It's such an opportunity to really impact the lives of the people we care about and the people we advocate for every day. And when you put it like that, Jane and Linda and Lisa, I feel that that's the only thing to do is stand on the right side of justice and move it a little bit further. And I feel the necessary change that we're looking at the justice sector also equally, we could share these learnings into our healthcare system, which is equally in need of reform. And I think standing up for families, our patients and clients, is exactly the direction that we need to lead. And by embarking on this new venture, I mean, I often think about, what did we do before this? You know, why wouldn't we partner with a profession that is equally committed to families and to justice and to the social determinants of health? And for so long, we've even siloed parts of health. We felt that you know, this domestic violence, or we see intimate partner violence, we see the effects of COVID have been exponentially increasing the stress on burdens on family. And the separation and divorces are at all-time high during this time. But what we've also realized is that for so long, we were siloing parts of our healthcare. We were neglecting the fact that our well-being rests in the seeing us as in a holistic perspective, like you said, Jane, holistic perspective of the system, but as the individual and also of the family. There are so many more stressors and that can impact toxic stress. And if we don't use a trauma-informed lens, or if we allow the system to continue as it operates, we're just really not contributing to the following generations. And I feel like, Linda, how you said that you could disrupt your family, you could disrupt the generation and your friend and colleague who now is a grandmother who's reflecting at her own family. I mean, myself, I feel that, you know, going through this process, I feel also been disruptive, but I've also broken a lot of intergenerational trauma that I will not allow to continue. And when we can channel our energy and our purpose into something that is greater than us, that would benefit many people, I feel that we can only do wonderful things. Now, if people are coming to the table and they have a zest and a passion, what would be your advice, Jane, to them?
Well, if there are people that are listening to this vodcast, I'd say join us right and start talking. Let's get together. Or if you are already working in your community with lawyers, just go have a coffee and start talking about your different experiences, but you'll probably find some similar experiences and just start talking about it. But I do think we're on our way at the very, very early stages of creating a structure that you'll be able to work within. So it won't just be the occasional conversation here and there, but a bigger thing, an alliance between physicians and lawyers, but also this bigger collaborative that I've been talking about is an intersectoral collaborative. And you know, Rami, when you were talking about how there are things in the health sector, I think the thing about the justice sector is there's a whole ecosystem. Of course, you know, human beings don't live in one sector or another sector. They live in the world. It's upstream that the health sector can work. Maybe it doesn't always. I mean, you say it's often dealing with the accidents at the end of the day. Certainly the justice sector is there. We are dealing with downstream, and the ones that get to court, at least it's the downstream ones where there probably a lot of the adults have had adverse childhood experiences and more than one, and perhaps have not had the opportunities to build the positive childhood experiences that we know that can be there. And so we're dealing with things when they don't work, but we keep realizing that it's got to be dealt with upstream. And so some of what we have to learn as a justice sector is how to recognize that and how to possibly refer out and move it upstream. And in order to do that, we need to have relationships. We need to have relationships with other people in other sectors. So my advice would be go develop some relationships with people, other professionals that you know in your community. You may know them a little bit. Get to know them better and talk about what you might do together.
I was thinking about what you're saying, Jane, about the upstream. When I think about this, I think, wouldn't it be nice to have family law movies not romanticize the courts? Wouldn't it be nice to have children who are in high school learning about mediation and ways to resolve matters other than adversarial and the benefits of those and what, you know, what, where the adversarial system works versus where a more early non-adversarial option might work, and children learning that and maybe teaching their parents that, and having parents going through separation and divorce, actually getting some education at the front end and learning what the options are and really empowering them in that way, and not getting legal advice, but also all other supports, parenting counselors and coaches and medical advice and for all their needs. And I agree with the reaching out between the professions rather than lawyers subpoenaing doctors. Wouldn't it be nice to work together and just pick up the phone and see what our respective clients and patients need? Because we're dealing with the same people.
That's a great thought. Linda.
So I'm just going to throw this out there just as a what's in it for me. So if you're thinking about becoming involved with this work, what I find is that we do have to address multiple levels. So we do have to address our individual level, we have to address systemic level and cultural levels. But the beautiful thing that I find is that if we want to affect change on a really powerful level, it needs to start with us. And so that's where it started with me. It started with me and my own child. And because I learned all of this information, because I learned the value of relationships, that very quickly had this ripple effect on my immediate family. And so I know now the value of me being okay. So I know that self-care is so important, you know, how I sleep, how I exercise, if I interact with my friends and family, all of those things are a necessity to my life. And on that foundation, I build my relationships outward. So what's in it for me in all of this is I know that I'm important. I'm a huge piece of this puzzle. And if I'm not okay, all of the other people around me are not going to be okay, especially my children. So that's a little plug for it's, you're not just going to affect systems. You're also going to possibly, very possibly change your own life.
I love how you said that, Linda. It's not just about systems, but it's also a possibility of how to change your life. And when I look at this opportunity and this bridging and the beauty in this is to be able to have dialogue, to create friendship and kinship and allyship in a sense of where sometimes you feel that the world has just set to keep us apart, or now we have an opportunity, a meeting of the minds, may it be, to collaborate in a space which is meaningful to our patients and our clients, and to have outcomes that have not yet been determined. But now I absolutely believe wholeheartedly that knowing what we know about ACEs, knowing what we know about trauma-informed practice, and how both of our systems have been implicated in causing toxic stress and adversarial consequences, how we can lead with intention to do better. And I think you also said, Linda, when you know better, you do better. And now with all of your expertise, Jane, Lisa, Linda, I am so excited about this opportunity to create this table and dialogue. I'm going to ask each of you now for closing remarks before we sign off. Linda, I'll start with you if you want to share.
I'm just really excited about this collaborative. Really happy that you've given us this venue to share and to speak about it. And maybe I'll just end with reinforcing that relationships are key. And, you know, the quality of our relationships, how we make one another feel when we're in our presence, is happily where we get to focus. We don't have to just focus on spending more money on drugs and diagnostics. So it is, it's a great shift, the direction that we're going.
I share Linda's excitement. And I also just want to thank you, Rami, for I met you late last year, and it was, your energy level is absolutely amazing. And who'd have thought that there'd be president of the Doctors of BC and the president of the Law Society focusing on families in this way and working together? I think it's extremely exciting, and I can't think of another time when it was done. So I'm very much looking forward to our event, and I thank you for your energy and passion for the subject.
Thank you so much, Lisa. That's it means a lot. It actually does. And the fact that we are in this together for our patients and our families and our clients, and we're going to embark on something. I truly believe it's revolutionary in the way that we even have an opportunity that we've taken some time out to have deliberate dialogue and conversations. Jane, final words?
Yeah, I just like to say that the fact that the two presidents have gotten together in this way is a demonstration of how important it is that we come together and start talking. Because that's, you know, it's because of relationship building that this alliance is happening. And you never know quite where things are going to take you. I remember, Rami, when you called me up the first day, like I had, I guess I was given your name and I called you, but whatever. And then, you know, and then connecting into Lisa and the two of you connecting together and all this happening, I would not have predicted this. And, but if you don't create the spaces to do it, then it won't happen. So I'm quite sure that when we have these sessions, these dialogues, I know things will happen from them, and they may happen at the community level. Things will happen and we won't even hear about them. We won't even know about them, but they will happen. So thank you so much for organizing today's event, for the Doctors of BC for doing that. I've really enjoyed being on the panel and really appreciate the work that you're doing and the fact that you're ready to come together with us and see if we can do something that's going to make things better for families.
Well, thank you so much again to all of you. I have so much gratitude for being able to facilitate this with all of your leadership today, as well as all of the staff support at Docs of BC. For making this happen. I do really think that this is synergy and there's going to be some wonderful things that do come of this. And I think the first step has been awareness. The second step is the action and the third step being allyship. And this is the way we walk towards a future that's better for our families that we're creating. And so today, thanks for joining us. This has been Doc Talks, a Doctors of BC production. We welcome you to continue to stay tuned to see what our future podcasts and vodcasts have to share. And again, just very thankful for this opportunity. Looking forward to much more in the future.